Hi, everyone. I'm Anita Lustria, and for many years I did live radio. Then I transitioned to the podcast world where I feel I found my home. I love talking about spiritual formation, justice issues, and spiritual practices. Throw in the Enneagram, movies, and current events from time to time, and that's what you get on the podcast. I'm glad you've come along for the ride. Welcome to Faith Conversations. Welcome to Faith Conversations, everyone. I've been looking forward to this podcast so much because I am a huge fan of emotionally healthy spirituality. And of course, the guy behind it, actually, he and his wife, Peter Scazzaro, is with me here today. But along with his wife, Jerry, they are founders of Emotionally Healthy Discipleship. It's a groundbreaking ministry that moves the church forward by slowing the church down in order to multiply deeply changed leaders and disciples. Well, we're going to get into what that means, what that looks like. But first, a big welcome to Pete Scazzaro to Faith Conversations.
Anita, thank you. It's so nice to be with you.
Well, I am delighted to have you here. We've talked off and on through the years, and I am a big fan of emotionally healthy spirituality. And when I saw I think it came through in my Facebook feed, actually, when I saw the book Emotionally Healthy Discipleship release, I loved the subtitle, Moving from Shallow Christianity to Deep Transformation. My question, I wanted to know what alerted you to the fact that deep transformation wasn't happening, because there's emotionally healthy spirituality. I thought that was huge for the church, but then you started kind of seeing some things. So I'm curious then what the impetus was for emotionally healthy discipleship.
Well, I think, I mean, I'd like to say, because all those people out there are messed up, but the truth is it began with me and realizing that my own following of Jesus and discipleship had large holes in it. And it was in it began with my own reality of life, hitting life, going through the regular developmental stages of growing up. And by my mid-30s, I'm pastoring a church at that point. It was clear that there were some large holes in my life. And then, of course, it evidenced itself in my marriage with my wife and parenting and all that. And then, of course, I saw it all around me in the church. So it began really very personal. And then over the years, it has become really evident that it's not simply my own problem or our local church's problem here in New York City, but I realized it was national, it was rural, suburban, urban. And then as I began to travel, it was global. It was Africa, Asia, Latin America, the Mideast. It was everywhere. And so as I just began, I guess I've been on this journey now 25, 26 years now, realize that the core of the core issues has to do with shallow discipleship. That is the great challenge. And how do you get at that has been my life work here. And so it's been quite a journey. And if I say anything, Anita, it gets clearer and clearer as time moves on.
Well, and I'm grateful you're still around to be writing books and helping us move on, you know, with this. I mean, I think when someone is authentic and vulnerable about their own journey, that goes a long way. I mean, I think people sit up and take notice, for one thing. And one of the things I especially appreciated was the fact that in the first part of the book, you outline the four failures that undermine deep discipleship. I thought, number one, I thought these failures were really insightful. I'm wondering how you landed on these. And then I'd love for you to kind of briefly outline them for people so they know what these failures are that you are looking at.
Yeah. Well, just, you know, landing on why is it that things were so shallow? That big question.
Yes.
So I've been wrestling with for a very, very long time when I actually began to say, I've got to put this in one book. And then of course, how'd we get here? And so that struggle, I think I probably spent 6 months. Imagine I'd already been in it 24, 25 years, but 6 months saying, What are the reasons beneath the reasons? I mean, because you can have a thousand reasons. We can blame technology. We can blame social media. We can blame breakdown of the family. We could blame so many things.
And can I just interject too? I remember thinking, for me, it was just moving to a different church. You know, I grew up in very conservative circles, kind of fundamentalist. I thought, broadening out, moving somewhere different, that will cure this. I'll find a different kind or better, deeper discipleship. And then I realized, of course, that was not the case. So I guess I wanted to interject that. We sometimes think moving from one point A to point B or somewhere else, we'll find it. And I didn't find that to be true.
Yeah. So I landed on four core deep issues that I believe without them being addressed, we will not get to a place of deep transformation in our lives. And thus, I think, impacting the world in a positive way for Christ. So you want me to go through them?
I would love for you to mention them. I might have a question along the way.
Yeah. So the first is I just say simply, we tolerate emotional immaturity. We have a view of spirituality that's so super spiritual. We're in the Bible, we're in worship, we're doing the sacraments, whatever it might be. But like, it's not grounded in like the fact that we're human beings made in God's image. And so we don't address this, our humanity, our feelings, the integration of our limits, the integration of loving people, humility, approachability, softness. Like we don't deal with that as core to our discipleship. We kind of got this, it's all about, Bible study and worship and prayer. And we've kind of, our lives are very compartmentalized. And so we do tolerate a lot of craziness in around us. So that's my first thing. We tolerate emotional immaturity, which is a whole, I'll unpack it in the rest of the book, but that's, we have it split and it can't be split.
To me, that is absolutely huge. And it points to each of us as individuals. If we tolerate emotional immaturity in ourselves, then we're not going to also be part of the conversation or help hold anyone else accountable if we're not dealing with it in our own lives.
Exactly. I'd say emotional health, emotional maturity and spiritual maturity can't be separated. That's our basic thesis, that it's not possible to be spiritually mature while remaining emotionally immature. So while I graduated seminary, I was pastoring a church, preaching the Bible, I was an emotional infant, leading a church. And it was very embarrassing. And it was reflected in my close relationships. People close to me could see it, but I didn't want to look at it because that wasn't real spirituality, right? So that split, and that wasn't until I was 37 years old that I finally was confronted with it. And it was revolutionary for me.
Every once in a while, someone will ask me why I married my husband. And I will give a variety of reasons, but I will tell them near the top of that list is emotional health, an emotionally healthy person.
Wow.
And that was super important to me.
Wow.
And usually, almost always their eyes kind of widen and go, what really? And what does that mean? And what, but I will tell someone, if you're not marrying someone who's emotionally healthy, maybe this is a good point to run for the hills and rethink the relationship.
Absolutely. And actually there's a really good assessment you can download for free in 15 minutes on our website. Go to emotionallyhealthy.org/mature, and it's a personal assessment. Am I an emotional infant, child, adolescent, or adult? It takes about 15 minutes, but it's a great snapshot. Actually, it's based on the 7 marks of emotionally healthy discipleship that's in this book. And it's a great, quick way to get a sense of where am I right now? And
that's great.
Yeah, it's a great way to get people started.
And I'll post that in the show notes too, everybody. Which I want to say, the assessments that are included in this book, Emotionally Healthy Discipleship, are incredible. I just want to spit that out before I forget that.
Well, actually, it's a chapter 2 is the assessment.
Is it? It's fantastic.
We make it for free. It's free for just go, you don't need to buy the book, you know, just download that assessment, do it right online if you like. And just to get people started, like, okay, I have a problem.
That is awesome. That's great. All right. So that was the first failure there. Okay.
The second is that we emphasize doing for God over being with God. In other words, we're so active, we're overloaded that we don't, we're not slowed down enough to actually have a being where we're present with ourselves and with God. And so we end up running on fumes. We're living our lives out of a cup that's empty.
Yeah.
Versus I'm living my life out of a cup that overflows. And that's why the call of Jesus is first that we might be with him. Mm. That was the call for the 12 disciples. And then he has things for us to do. And so the being was always meant to be first. And again, I'll just talk about myself. I see it because the implications, when that's out of whack, everything's out of whack. Mm-hmm. So that's the second one. And that's a big one, slowing down.
And I'm just going to say, you know, for as popular as the Enneagram typology is out there today, as people are getting to know themselves a little bit more, you might pay attention to your particular bent. I happen to be an Enneagram type 3. And I had to really grow into the being. That was a deal, huge deal for me.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
I hear you.
And actually, I think if you're going to come into your bet, I mean, each of our numbers in Enneagram are really a gift that we're to offer to the world. And I think if we're going to get the best of our number, not the shadow,
yes,
it requires some sort of a silence and contemplative life of being.
Yes.
So we access that.
Yeah, good. All right, what's number three?
Three is we ignore the treasures of church history.
I loved this. This surprised me that this was one of the failures. I don't think I thought about it, but I love this. What do you mean by this?
You know, when we think of the church in the world, there are at least three main branches of the church in the world. There's the Orthodox churches of mostly the eastern part of the world in Syria and Iraq and Ethiopia and Egypt, etc., Russia. And then we've got the Roman Catholic Church, and then we have the Protestant churches. And actually, some would argue there's a fourth stream of churches coming in places like Africa and China that have almost like emerged under their own in the last 150 years, which is fascinating. And some scholars actually argue for a fourth stream. But the point is that every stream, you're listening, you may be a Roman Catholic, different Protestant denomination, or maybe even Orthodox, but there's only one church, and it's the church is those who have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. It doesn't matter what church you go to. But every stream has its strengths and weaknesses and blind spots. And I think one of my discoveries is the riches of the church are found in all the streams. Mm, and so we ignore the treasures. So, you know, Every stream thinks they're the best, they're the only one, or kind of a fundamentalist narrowness. The Orthodox have it, the Roman Catholics have it, the Protestants have it. And it's kind of this fundamentalism narrowness. I don't want to learn from other people, you know, and they're wrong on this and wrong on that and wrong on this, but everybody's got dirty laundry. So I spent, you know, one of my closest friends for the last 40 years, I went to school with him, he's a PhD church historian.
Oh,
and so
it's
been like all these years, we've just been sharing books and so I've done a lot of work on history, and I don't think you can do it with just one stream because there's only one church. So that's a really big one, because as you'll see in the rest of the booklet, I'm trying to draw from the riches of all the traditions and bring that into our discipleship, because there is so much great stuff, and globally as well.
Oh, I love that. I think that's so true. And I loved even that phrase, you know, we don't want to look at our own dirty laundry. And there's something about us as humans, you know, we think our little corner of the world is the right stream, and we miss out.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And we get our identity from being over and against other people, which is not a good, that's not a good place of, you know, finding our identity.
Right. Right. All right. Number four.
Well, then we define success wrongly. That's the fourth core one. And this is very, this goes back to Jesus and the temptation in the wilderness. It's in every culture in the world. And that is, we get a sense of I'm doing well if these externals are happening well. So it's all built on a false self. You know, if the numbers are up, I'm getting more income. My kids are all stable and getting at the good schools. It's all this. My church is growing in new number. I'm moving to a better neighborhood. I'm getting a better house. I mean, my friends think well of me. It's all this external stuff of defining success. And the fact that we define it wrong, it sends you on a path that everything is messed up. And so you're doomed to shallowness, because success in scripture is becoming the person God calls you to become and doing what God calls you to do. Well, that's a totally different definition of success. So these four, I determined like these four are, unless we look hard at these four things, any solution is going to be superficial. As my wife likes to say often, oh, we're simply moving chairs around the Titanic. It may look different, but the ship is still going nowhere. And I think all the scandals of the last, you know, 20 plus 30, 40 years, I mean, are an indication of the shallowness and superficiality that goes on in our churches. Just attending church and listening to sermons and, you know, participating is not enough. I mean, that's not how Jesus made disciples in his day, and it's no different today. It's slow. It's can be painful, but it's liberating. It's a death process, but it's a life process. You're going to go down, but you're actually going to go up. You know, it's this great mystery of it's scary to follow Jesus and let him tinker with your inner life. But it's totally liberating.
It's a great phrase, to let Jesus tinker with your inner life. I love that. That's good. You know, it's interesting. I was with Moody Radio for many years and had a huge, you know, if you look at numbers, a very large radio following. And I'm on a different path. I'm a spiritual director now, and I have a podcast. And every once in a while, I feel this sense that, oh, I should maybe be ramping up to something bigger. And I go, oh, no, 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 no. That's not Jesus speaking.
Exactly.
You are exactly where you're in this path, on this path that has been outlined for you, that is so enriching and rewarding and not always easy. But yes, I fully identify with this.
Well, as a spiritual director, what's the core of being a follower of Jesus? It's listening.
Absolutely.
To him. It's listening to him. And I love the story of actually, it's interesting. I mean, I get these seven marks of emotionally having discipleship, but actually the core of the book is found in three words. And it's actually in about seven or eight pages. And it's the invitation of Jesus is to relax in him. Relax in him, which is creating a life where I'm actually relaxing and trusting in Jesus. Like I said, secondly, is I'm detaching from all attachments. I'm just detaching from everything but him. That's a great work, great Meister Eckhart's work.
Yeah.
And the third is I'm listening. That Mount of Transfiguration, when Jesus, you know, appears with Elijah and Moses, and Peter starts making plans, you know, and this is great. And Jesus, you know, stops him. I mean, the Father interrupts from heaven. Listen to him. Listen to Jesus. And I think relax, detach, and listen capture to me the core of what it means to be a follower. And because really, today too, Anita, what am I doing? I want to listen to Jesus today.
Yeah.
Like that's a successful day. That's a great day. So in a sense, I'm doing spiritual direction. That's life. That is life itself.
Preach.
Every day for every one of us. So yeah,
that's great. I love that.
Thank you for that work you're doing.
So, you know, you just alluded to the seven marks of healthy discipleship. You know, it's one thing to outline these four failures that undermine the deep discipleship. And I think it's really important for us to hear those and
yeah. So I'll just read them. I'll list them and maybe one or two comments, and then you can can jump on anyone you think is really worth touching on. So the bulk of the Emotionally Healthy Discipleship book is the seven marks of healthy discipleship, or that's going to deeply transform people. So, okay, the other mark one is be before you do. which we mentioned earlier, that I have a life of I've got some silence. I've got solitude. I let myself feel. I bring those feelings to God. I'm monitoring the rhythms of my days, the rhythms of my weeks, the rhythm of my months and years, and so that I've got a being with Jesus and myself out of which I'm doing life. That's number one and core.
Which might mean for me, for anyone, getting to know spiritual practices more. Exactly. If that's a foreign term, you know, learn more about the spiritual practices. And yeah, that's a part of this first one.
And one of the cores I mentioned in there is I don't know if it's, there's certain spiritual practices that are core, like scripture and others, community, but the one or two that's quite critical, I believe, in our age is silence and stillness. That we need a dimension of silence and stillness to get cultivated. And that's a practice, you know, in and of itself. So that's the one, be before you do. The second mark is follow the crucified, not the Americanized Jesus. And by that, actually this came out of studying for a few years the Gospels and how Jesus, what was he trying to do with these 12 in discipling them? And I realized, he was driving out of them all these ideas of what it meant to follow God. They've been formed in their case, first century Judaism, you know, but it's the same temptations that face every one of us in the world at every age. I call it the Americanized Jesus because it's so stark and personified in American culture. So it's follow the crucified Jesus means we reject popularity, we reject the world's definition of greatness, we reject the world's definition of success, and we don't avoid suffering and failure. And so it's such a radical upside down vision. And that's why Jesus says what humans find detestable is in God's sight beautiful, and vice versa. In other words, the kingdom is countercultural. It's upside down. And so we've got to let Jesus, you know, follow him to places that we don't know where he's going, what he's doing, why he's doing this. But even our humiliations and setbacks, this is part of the way God frees us, you know, from our false selves, from illusions. And this is the journey. So that's the second mark. I'm sorry. Okay. That's a whole big one right there.
Yeah, it is. I'm kind of just going, whew. Yeah.
That's okay. A big one. The third mark is embrace God's gift of limits, which is just a whole big thing in scripture. I mean, if you look at Adam and Eve, for example, in the Garden of Eden, they were to trust God, but the first test was about crossing a limit. God said, you can eat from any tree in the garden, but don't eat from this one particular tree. And God doesn't explain why. But it was a limit, they crossed it. Every time we cross a limit that God places in front of us because he loves us and he's good, like when we try to do too much, right? You try to do a podcast, five podcasts, right, in a week or whatever, grow this ministry. And we end up in all kinds of trouble. Mm-hmm. And so the gift of limits, the key word, it's limits are a gift sent from God. And we have limits of our time, our energy, our bodies, I mean, intellectually, physically, monetarily, I mean, that. Limits are everywhere. So I expound on that. So receive the gift of limits. Very big.
Yes.
The next one, the fourth mark, is discover the treasures buried in grief and loss.
Can I just say before you even talk about this one, when I read this as one of the seven marks of healthy discipleship, I thought, where have you been all of the church's life? Why? You know, I'm so glad that I'm surprised it was in there, and yet utterly delighted and firmly believe this is a really important mark. I feel like we don't know how to engage with grief and loss at all in the church, period.
I mean, that's why COVID-19 has been such a difficult season. But if you look at Judaism, you look at scripture, we have a whole book in the Bible called Lamentations, right? We've got 2/3 of the Psalms are laments or griefs before God. Job, 35 chapters is him grieving. Jeremiah, man of sorrows. Jesus himself was called man of sorrows in Isaiah. So it's all over the Bible, but again, it's very un-Western.
Yes.
We're bigger, better, and up and to the right. That's the culture we live in. And so people say, let's get over COVID. Let's move on. Get back to where we were. And no, that is so inappropriate. because we just had almost 600,000 deaths in our own country here in the United States. Like, hello.
Let alone what's going on in India now, in Brazil, in the world. Yes.
Exactly. Right. And so to mature, and I call this chapter Discover the Treasure is Buried in Grief and Loss, because it's the way that it's a way we meet God, that we meet God in no other way, in our losses. And there are treasures in darkness, as Isaiah chapter 43 says. But there's a pathway to feel our sadness, to wait on the Lord with it, bring it to God. It's a huge discipleship issue. I don't believe it's biblically or just practically possible to grow into a mature person without grieving your losses. But if you grieve your own losses, you can grieve anybody's losses. You become a compassionate person, a loving person.
Short story. Many, many years ago now, I went through a divorce. And I, you know, hindsight is a gift as well. And I saw that I was not a compassionate person before my life shattered and fell apart. And it was so sad for me to see this and realize it. And yet, over time, how grateful I was that this shattering occurred that completely changed me in ways I didn't anticipate. And one of those was that I now had compassion for anyone in the middle of crisis, grief, loss. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, they are seasons of intense grief and loss. I mean, that's what unites us as human beings. I mean, everyone in the world's going through loss to some degree. In fact, we're going to die having lost everything. We'll lose our health, all of our friends, all of our roles that we hang on to, and we will die absolutely naked before God. So all of life is really a journey of losses. And so teenagers go through losses. I mean, just so many. And so it's such an avenue to meet God and meet ourselves.
Yes, but we can't be saying, get over it. That's right.
And people misappropriate the Bible and quote Bible verses out of context, that it's what Job's friends did when he was suffering. They were quoting the Bible wrongly. All right. Sorry.
Thank you.
That was a big one for me.
Yes, keep going.
Well, the fifth one is make love the measure of maturity, which that's a big one too. I mean, that's a gigantic one. How do you measure if a person is spiritually mature? Well, Jesus and Paul would say it's something called love. In other words, approachability, non-judgmentalness, gentleness, yes, meekness, mercy. People feel safe around you. I mean, these are loving our enemies. Anybody can love those who love you. And so I get into that chapter into the work of Martin Buber, versus I, it, and our ability to go into relationships and see people as sacred, as holy, we may disagree with them totally, but I come into it as a learner. So again, it's hard. I'm married. I got four daughters. My four daughters have lots of opinions about lots of things. You know, it's the ability to go into a conversation and be a learner, let myself be changed by it. And so Buber talks about, you know, in this book in particular, this issue was redefining maturity is really gigantic. And I realized that was the big clash of Jesus with the religious leaders. They didn't define maturity by the basis of mercy. And Jesus kept saying, no, go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. And you know, they were so cold and judgmental, and they had all these tight categories of what was acceptable and not acceptable to be holy. And Jesus was doing all these unspiritual things. And, you know, they crucified him.
According to them. Yeah, right. Well, and I go back to my divorce and I say that was the beginning of my journey away from being a Pharisee. You know, I used to judge people that got divorced. You know, I used to judge people like me. Wait a minute. I would call it my journey away from being a Pharisee, but it better words would be a journey toward love.
Yes.
Totally a journey toward love, which is also a journey of, at least for me, of letting go
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was talking to one of my daughters who's 26 about her relationship with her older sister, and she's feeling, quote, judged by her older sister. And I said to her, I said, first of all, you don't know if you're mind reading that she's judging you. But secondly, is that you're judging her. I said, can you just let it go and let her be her? And she, oh, that's so hard, Dad. I said, yeah, just let her be. She's on a journey in life, and that's her journey. And you think you know what's best for her. And I said, you don't know what's best for her. I mean, I don't know what's best for her. And she's not asking for your advice. Why are you giving it? That says more about you than it does her. But this is her discipleship. This is her formation of how do you deal with that difficult relationship with my older sister, right? Who's 8 years older than me. And she's 26. The other one's 34. But this is real discipleship, right? And working it out very practically.
I love that. Discipleship is working it out very practically.
Yes.
I love that. And I realize that this journey of discipleship, this journey toward love, the thought just left my little brain here. But it's not just about letting go, but it's also about trusting God with not only my own life, but everyone else's life. It's very much a journey of trusting God. It's like, oh, I thought I trusted God. Oh, the journey toward love is really about trusting God.
It is. It's about letting it relax. It's detach and it's listen. And it's amazing. All right. So that's the fifth. The sixth mark of a discipleship that deeply transforms lives is that we break the power of the past. And that really gets into, I've got to be willing to look at my family of origin. Over 3 to 4 generations on how my family did everything from bonding, connection, criticism, defining success, marriage, sexuality, singleness, work, you name it. And so, but we've been formed by our, I went and did some doctoral work in marriage and family because I saw how when people came to Jesus, he said, he who does not hate father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And it wasn't that he wasn't saying honor your parents, but he was making the point that to be a disciple, you've got to be ruthless in cutting off from your biological family, things that don't belong in my new family. Because when you come to Christ, you're in the new family of Jesus. The church is meant to be a radical countercultural place where we're all of us, like Abraham, are leaving our families and our cultures in order to follow God into an unknown place, into this new, with Jesus, into the new family of Jesus. So this is hard work. So, you know, we've been working on, again, whether it's loving or how do I get at my family of origin stuff, creating some skills that help people get at how do I break the power of the past? How do I even know what it is? And so it's, again, these are like pillars in our lives. So even now I'm raising 4 adult children, 2 are married with their own children. So my family, I'm Italian American, had a way. My mother treated me like before my parent died, I was still 12.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't matter. She was 85. She was still telling me what to do. All right. What to wear, how to behave. And she never did the growing up task of treating me like a peer. And then even though I became her parent at the end of her life, but so I'm learning, how do I be peers with my daughters now? They have their own families where I'm not their parent. In fact, the future is we begin, I'm their parent, right? They're small.
Yeah.
We grow up, they become adults, we're now peers, and then eventually they become my parent. At the end of my life, they'll be taking care of me, right? So, but these are meant to be maturing, healthy tasks we go through. So I never learned how to have healthy relationships with my adult children, my son-in-law. I'm leaving my family of origin, this Italian-American thing, and I don't give advice unless my adult children ask me.
Ooh. Say that louder.
I don't give discipline input about how to raise my grandchildren because I'm not the primary parent. I'm a helper. I'm a support. Yeah. And we have a great relationship, but I do have to recognize my role and the limits of my role, and it's wonderful. But I'm redoing my family of origin, so all of us have to break the power of the past. That's a very big thing.
Oh my goodness, that is so big. I just want to scream. That is so big. but the question that it really raises for me is, really any of these, and we're not yet at the last one, last of these marks of healthy discipleship. But what? Not everyone's going to sign on to this journey, and that's where I realize I sometimes, once again, it's over and over that I have to come to the place of letting go.
Yeah.
I am, and you, I guess you just said it in the whole family of origin piece, I am responsible before God for myself.
Yes.
But I'm not responsible for anyone else.
Exactly. Oh. You're not. I mean, we want to bless people.
Yes.
As doors open, but I don't know if you know the old Hasidic tale that I can't quote it exactly right, but as he was on his deathbed, this great Hasidic rabbi said, you know, when I was younger, I tried to change the world. Then I realized I couldn't do that. So I tried to change my country. I couldn't do that. I realized, let me change my city. I couldn't do that. And I realized, let me change my small community. I couldn't do that. Let me try changing my family. But then I realized, you know what? The only person I can change is myself. And if I allowed God to change me, maybe I could have changed my family, and maybe my town community would have been changed. Maybe the country would have been changed. Maybe the world would have been changed.
Wow.
I learned this wisdom at the very end of my life that I should have just focused on me. The rest would have taken care of itself. And I think there's some wisdom in that. I write, right. And I do the emotional discipleship and invite people on this journey. But to me, it's like, I'm just trying to be faithful one day at a time myself, you know, and follow Jesus. And as God opens doors, I'm be glad to share a few things I've learned along the way. But God's got it.
All right, the
last mark is, which kind of, in a sense, culminates in all of them, which is lead or live out of weakness and vulnerability. In other words, I'm not pretending to be anything I'm not. It's really, when I think of like Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, his face is on the ground before the Father. He's overwhelmed. He's prostrate, and he's struggling with the will of God. Mm. He doesn't put on a face like, I got it. Everything's good. You know, on the cross, his last words are, my God, why? In other words, he's weak. He's honest. He's not pretending. I had one pastor say to me, if I ever did what Jesus did here, I'd get fired. I would lose my job. You know, it's like David commits adultery and murder, and then he lets it get recorded in the history books, and he writes a song about it, Psalm 51, to be sung in church. Like he writes in Psalm 51, the Lord does not delight in religious offerings and burnt offerings, but in a broken and contrite heart. That what God's after is weakness. Mm. That's the beauty of it. That in weakness, God's power can actually flow. And that's what Paul realized. You know, his strength was in his weakness. He had his thorn in the flesh. He couldn't get rid of it. And he asked God to get rid of it, and God said no. And it was that weakness. He says, this is the source of my authority, actually, of my brokenness. And so rather than hiding all of our mistakes and trying to put out this person, we got it all together, it's the genuineness of the fact that we are all weak and vulnerable, every one of us. Hey, we can put up a wall and not let people in and try to hide it, but it's just not true. Mm. We're human beings, we're weak and we're vulnerable. So we want to, that seventh mark is that we actually, we glory in this. Mm. We're just honest about it. And it's very freeing. And it's core to discipleship.
This is a powerful list. I think it leaves me thinking about how important this list is, how powerful it is, and also realizing it's part of the process, certainly. Mm-hmm. But how do we implement this? I'm thinking about like the local, I guess I'm thinking about the individual, but I'm also thinking about the local church setting. How do we implement this into the life of the church?
So a good, you know, that's I think a fantastic question, because we want to create a culture, right? A healthy community. That's a gift to the world. So one is there, let me invite your folks and listeners to, there's a free discussion guide that goes with the book, and just go to emotionallyhealthy.org/discipleship and you can download a discussion guide for free. So as you mentioned in your church, you want to talk about it with some people. It's really a great starting place because it's going to rock your world. Like, okay, but now what? And so we have developed over these decades a course that we call the Emotionally Healthy Discipleship Course. And it's actually a two-part course. It's not a small group curriculum. It's a course where you're actually, like, you do it. You do the material that you're in this book. So you're going to make a list of your losses over your lifetime. And then what's God maybe trying to say to you in them? You'll do a genogram of your family of origin, looking at your family over 3-4 generations. And what are some unbiblical commandments you got to step aside? You know, you'll learn some new skills on how do I love? How do I do a clean fight versus a dirty fight? Mm. How do I speak clearly, respectfully, and honestly? So it's a two-part course. It's actually the fruit of over 2 decades of work.
Wow.
And it's done by it came out about 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago now. It's being done by about 1,000 churches.
Wow.
Just the United States and Canada. But you have to, we say to people, don't bring it to your church, please. If you're not living it, like, don't do it. Like, this is not a program. Sure. This is a life. There's no rush. But you can go on our website, look around, you know, you can get some taste of it, you know, it's free, you know, and just explore it. But I think the book's a good place to start. This is a long journey. I say it takes 7 to 10 years to transform a community to bring this in. It's a very long journey.
That makes sense.
And taking Jesus full time with the three, day and night, it took him 3 years and one of them didn't work out. Okay. So we change slow, but the change, even though it looks like it's a mustard seed, it's incredibly powerful. We change just a little bit. Boy, the ripple effect is gigantic. So when you bring something like this into a community, it is powerful. But someone's got to have the courage to say, okay, I'm going to get into this. And, you know, I know your pastor, Steve. You know, to bring this course there would require someone to get trained, begin to live it out, you're talking 6 months, you know, to 12 months, you know, and then getting into it. And then, you know, it's just a long process. And it takes, the reason this book moving from shallow Christianity to one that deeply transforms, that's a gigantic shift in American shallow Christian culture. But the world desperately needs us to go on this slow journey because the world needs God. He really is the best news in the universe.
Oh, yeah. How do you not lose heart?
Oh, I see God moving and alive. I think, you know, the kingdom of God's always been a mustard seed. And it's, you know, when Jesus was here walking on earth, he was imperceptible to most. They couldn't. This is God. You know, it didn't look like God.
Right.
It doesn't look like much.
Not what we thought family. God was going to look like.
Exactly. Yeah. They're looking. He's coming on. He's not riding on a war horse, a stallion coming to Jerusalem. He's on a donkey. I mean, he's been crucified. It just didn't look. So I think we tend to have, we're looking for external, again, worldly definitions of power and success. While God is invisibly working, he's working even through some of the tragedies that are happening in our world today. I think God is trying to get our attention to make some shifts, to deepen our relationship with him. There are gifts coming in the darkness to us from God. And I think those are the ones we want to receive and be on that journey with him.
Well, thank you for your faithfulness over the years and continuing to elevate this conversation. I really commend to people your newest book here, Emotionally Healthy Discipleship, Moving from Shallow Christianity to Deep Transformation. And as Pete Scazzaro just said, it's not for the faint of heart, but it is so worth the time. There's joy in the journey, even along with the difficulty, right? Oh, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. And to everyone else, I always say, keep the conversation going.